I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. This is the second half of my interview with Philip Blom about his book, A Wicked Company, The Forgotten Radicalism of the European Enlightenment. The essay that first made me fall in love with Diderot is D'Alembert's Dream, which he wrote and put in a drawer because he knew it could never be published in his lifetime. And I guess he didn't even want some of his papers to be published ever, but it was eventually published 70 years later. And the essay argues for sexual freedom. It presages artificial intelligence. Can you just say, you know, what's your impression of that essay? I mean, you talk in the book about many of his writings.
It's a very experimental. It's a story. It's in the form of a story. And it's a very experimental story because it talks about, you know, a materialist worldview. And it talks about, and it's very interesting. I find that really fascinating that you have the feeling that, you know, how at that time, how enormously far close observation could get you to what we today understand to be how the world really works. For instance, Diderot talks about, it's basically a dialogue between a doctor and the lover of D'Alembert, an actress. And she asks him all sorts of questions, and he puts forward a very informed, a very humane materialist worldview. And he basically says, for instance, you know, of course, when you see how people are born, how people are made, they inherit something from their fathers and from their mothers, but sometimes things go wrong. And it must be because both from the father and from the mother, there must be a kind of filament that tells the body how to construct itself. And indeed, it can only be that when two filaments meet and combine that another person exists. And sometimes in this union, something goes wrong, and then you get handicapped people. Then you get people with changes in the expression, but also perhaps with, you know, with terrible handicaps. And that is when this union basically describes the process of DNA
and evolution
without a microscope, without any way of knowing, just from simply deducting what must be the case by observing. And I think that is very exciting. But he puts forward this very informed materialist and rather humanist worldview, and he does that in a very experimental way. It's an exhilarating read, and I think, and that shows you something about Diderot. You know, these things were written before the French Revolution, in the 1760s and 70s. But still, if you read them today, sometimes your hair stands on end because they're such radical things. They're such daring things to say and to think still. And, you know, we've still got a lot of catching up to do.
His reflections on the materialist, the consequences of a materialist approach to the mind is just so far-reaching. He talks about how the inanimate things might eventually become intelligent, because if intelligence is the result of a certain construction of matter, then that would be possible. It might be possible to take apart people and put them back together later and make them alive again. And all kinds of that,
artificial intelligence is in there.
Yeah.
It's often misunderstood. People often think that he sort of thought like medieval alchemists, that anything could become anything else. And that's because he put that in an example, and he says marble can turn into flesh, and flesh into marble. What does he mean is that he says, well, you know, you can basically, he says already, matter must be constructed of molecules, and these molecules can turn up in different combinations and express themselves as very different things, as very different substances. And so if you grind down marble and you put it in someone's food, that will become part of his physical makeup, and the marble will have become flesh. But yes, it is true, you know, he says that the mind must, and that's not a new thought. Again, Lucretius, the late Roman writer in the 2nd century, wrote very movingly about that. But, you know, he said the mind must consist of molecules, just like obviously the body does, and there must be an interaction between the two. So whatever moves the body moves the mind, and vice versa.
Now, many historians have made a distinction between the British Enlightenment or the Scottish Enlightenment and the French Enlightenment, trying to distinguish between a statist version of the Enlightenment, the French Revolution, and David Hume and Adam Smith and a more mercantilist or not mercantilist, but a libertarian version. You don't seem to tell that story at all, because David Hume is a part of this circle of friends and a part of their political machinations.
Well, I think I touch on the story because there were certain philosophical differences between these, and I think they basically come from the environment they were in. David Hume lived in a relatively liberal environment, and he could, he knew, he writes in his inquiry about the fact that he was terribly shocked by his own revelations because he basically thought that they would make him into an intellectual leper, that people would no longer talk to him, they would regard him as a freak. But at least he knew that he wouldn't end up at the stake. And Hume's philosophy is, the non plus ultra of really the thinking things through to the ultimate consequences, the ultimate philosophical consequences. So he had little time for the atheist talk of the Holbach Circle, because he thought there's no way of philosophically coherently being an atheist. You can't disprove God just as little as you can prove him. So you can say that you're an agnostic, but of course being an atheist is philosophically, technically speaking, impossible. Diderot was rather impatient with that attitude, because basically his project was less than a philosophic one, almost a political one, a societal one. He wanted to move things on. He saw how people suffered. He saw, how this power of the church monopolized society, and whether in the last philosophical consequence you could call yourself an atheist. And incidentally, the same argument can be made about solipsism. There's no way of disproving solipsism. But at some point you have to make a pragmatic choice. Diderot had made that pragmatic choice, and he thought that that was good enough for him to argue against God. But there was an element of philosophical difference, and I think Hume brought a new dimension of intellectual rigor to the Salon, because he questioned everything, and he forced Diderot and Holbach and their friends to justify themselves, to argue much more robustly, much more far-reachingly than they had done before. But still, they remained friends until the ends of their lives. When Hume, after 3 years in Paris, moved back to England, they corresponded regularly, and I think they held each other in very high esteem.
The story you tell about Rousseau and his travels back and forth between England and France is just astonishing. I mean, how the man could have sustained his reputation. I mean, obviously you're a partisan of the anti-Rousseau crowd, but still, an astonishing story.
The story speaks for itself, really. Rousseau, I'm certain, was psychologically unwell. He was sick. He was paranoid. Back then, people didn't put it in that way because, those categories of understanding didn't exist. They called him mad, and they called him very ill-behaved. But Rousseau systematically alienated all his benefactors, all his patrons, and indeed all his friends. And he did so not only by being rude, but by writing against them publicly, by spreading lies about them, by bringing them in danger. And I think Rousseau was a very unwell man. Unfortunately, as we know today, reputations are not made by the people themselves, but reputations are made by works, and reputations are made by political interests and careers that come after people and that build up somebody or indeed destroy somebody, as in the case of Diderot, for different and ulterior political motives.
Rousseau
was very useful to the 19th century, and he was built up as a hero, though I personally think he's a very sinister thinker.
Me too. One of the things that is so important about a history like yours is, as you say, that figures who may not have written much themselves but played very important historical roles, like Baron D'Holbach, are brought back to our consciousness, but also the women of the time who were sometimes writing and, again, putting things in under pseudonyms or putting them in their pocket. because they weren't allowed a public intellectual life. You tell an amazing story about Louise Debonnet.
I think those women, that is a rather amazing thing. I mean, you mustn't forget that women didn't really get an intellectual education in these days. And that, of course, meant that in intellectual circles, they didn't really feature. Louise Debonnet got herself an intellectual education after the usual convent education and being married off to a man early who turned out to be a spendthrift and an abusive husband. And she, rather astonishingly, I mean, if you think of a woman in her early 20s to have that strength and independence of spirit, even today, never mind in the 18th century, you couldn't get divorced, but she got separated from him. She made sure that she had her own money. And she started to read voraciously. She started to cultivate a friendship with a philosophe. And she became a member of their circle, even if she couldn't be a very active member. She couldn't, you know, she wrote a huge autobiographical novel. She probably wrote articles for the Encyclopédie. But I think it shows the mettle of the philosophes, as you call them in French, the philosophers, Diderot and Holbach and their friends, that they didn't choose docile women. They didn't choose women as the society, as the education system of the day wanted them. They chose strong and independent women. Louise Debonnet was the mistress, and we would say today the common law wife or life partner of Melchior Grimm, the great friend of Diderot and a very important journalist at the time. Diderot himself, who had married early and unhappily, very incidentally, and that's a rather big irony, a very pious Catholic woman, had a 30-year relationship with a very independent and intellectual woman called Sophie Volant. And he confided in her, he presented his ideas and his works to her, he discussed with her. They sought out independent women, and as I said, Diderot tried to educate his own daughter to become one of these women. So I think, you know, they didn't just talk about the equality of man or indeed of women. They tried to do what they could about it, and indeed even for their private, their personal, and their sentimental lives, that chose women who would fit that bill.
I'm very conscious that it's almost 11 o'clock for you there in Austria.
I'm sorry. We have to wrap it up.
Can I ask one final question?
Go ahead.
Okay. The story that you tell, as you say, it's incredibly contemporary. Can you give me a couple thoughts about what it means for our contemporary intellectual debates? I mean, one obvious connection is the debate between the new atheists and other strains of humanistic thought. And many people attack the new atheists for saying, you know, you're so nasty, you're so mean, you're so, you know, you're so harsh.
Well, I think that's rather, you know, that's a very predictable answer. But the new atheists, you know, they can be rather strident. But, you know, I think that, you know, they're in a polemical position, much as Diderot was in the 18th century. But what really interests me is that I think our time has inherited, for very good reasons and for reasons I've tried to explain, much more from Rousseau than from Diderot, in the way that what Rousseau's real central achievement was that he, in a way, secularized not the world, but theology. He took the basic instincts of Christianity and of theology and cast them in a philosophical vocabulary, so you didn't have to be a believer anymore or a confessing believer to think these things. Now, what are these things? They are a hatred of your own body. They are a distrust of women, of sexuality. They are a hope for an afterlife, a hope for a metaphysical world. They are a belief in authority that is somehow given from above, and in power structures. And that is, unfortunately, the world in which we are still living. Think of Hollywood movies. You don't have to think of, you know, the Terminator movies to get a sort of Christological idea of the world, where the world has to be saved. You know, all the disaster movies basically are predicated, and you don't need to go only to movies. You know, we think of the world in terms of entering paradise or entering hell. That is a religious way of thinking. That is the way common to all ideologies. the fact that in Hollywood you are not allowed to show frontal nudity, but you are allowed to show somebody massacred or tortured to death, has a lot to do with a very Christian disdain for sex. I could go on. I think we still live, you know, I could go on to abortion, to stem cell research, to assisted suicide. Wherever you come to these things, if you still feel that there are very deep-rooted Christian reflexes in reacting to the world. And they have sort of been divested of their sacred vestment. They've been defrocked, but they are still intact. And they're essentially theological. And I think in that way, you know, we are still the heirs of Rousseau, and unfortunately not of Diderot, who had a tremendously liberating, humanistic way of looking at the world that I think our societies could benefit from enormously if they sought to reorientate themselves and to look at their own precepts in the light of day and not just accept what is essentially a theological way of seeing the world, but perhaps moving beyond that. So in that way, I think it is something that really concerns the debates of this day.
I've been speaking with Philip Blum. He's the author of a wonderful history called A Wicked Company, The Forgotten Radicalism of the European Enlightenment, available this year. And I highly recommend it. Thank you so much for joining us, and I hope that you still have guests to entertain there.
Thank you very much.
Okay, good night.
Okay, bye-bye.
This has been the second half of my interview with the historian Philip Blum about his book, A Wicked Company, The Forgotten Radicalism of the European Enlightenment. For the first half of the interview, go to IEET.org. To finish off the show, we're going to play a short story from Cory Doctorow about an artificial intelligence scenario and some of the military-industrial complex's response to the threats that artificial general intelligence might pose, which I think is a pretty realistic scenario of how doors might be broken down of computer scientists when and if the Homeland Security gets serious about that kind of a threat. And this is under a Creative Commons license, and Corey encourages us to repost them. So I will probably be including some of his other short stories. Some of his work is just too long for our show, but some of his other short stories will fit in Change Surfers in the future. So this is Pester Power by Cory Doctorow.
This story is from Cory Doctorow's new collection, With a Little Help. Visit craphound.com/WALH to buy the whole audiobook on CD, a paperback copy in one of four covers, or a super limited hardcover. This story, and the whole text of With a Little Help, are licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Share-alike non-commercial license. Copy it, share it, remix it. As Woody Guthrie said, this song is copyrighted in the U.S. under seal of copyright number 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it. We wrote it, that's all we wanted to do.
Pester Power by Cory Doctorow. Originally published in Communications of the Association for Computing Machinery, December 2008. Read by Mary Robinette Kowal. The NYPD Domestic Security Task Force executed its no-knock warrant against Annalisa Moore on 8:17 p.m. on the evening of June 3, 2013. Working the team were three stout officers in Nunmore black nanopore body armor and bulletproof boots, their goggles crowded with information-dense telemetry from an extensive array of sensors embedded on their persons and hovering aerostatically around the 16th floor of the Midtown student residence in which Moore dwelled. The ram blew through the standard-issue solid-steel New York door like it was Kleenex. The door was reinforced by Charlie bars set deep into the frame, and so the frame tore loose along with the door with a series of crunches and metallic snapping sounds, and the three officers on the ram dropped it as they crashed into the one-room studio, fanning out and making room for the officers behind them, who already had their arms drawn and set to full lethal automatic. Annalisa Moore slowly rose from her workbench. Standard issue, third-hand student furniture stabilized with steel angle brackets at each corner, and held up her long, skinny hands over her face in a universal gesture of, "Oh God, please don't kill me." The Ram Squad impersonally body-checked her to the floor and saran-wrapped her, while the follow-up team gusted her computer with great gouts of Freon, turning the whole room into an ice palace that misted frosted air out into the sultry New York night through the pathetic window that had been cracked open to catch a breeze. Moore caught some of the Freon, and when they lifted her up to carry her down the 16 flights to the waiting van, she crackled like fresh powder under long skis. Gina Genoese had visited the ultra-high security wing at Rikers Island before. 22 years in the public defender's office, and you'd get to see every nook of Rikers. She could have given docent tours. But the special prisoners unit was a new one on her. "I can't believe you're making me undress," she said to the bull, a tough old gal named Alana, with a Brooklyn accent like you hardly got anymore. Gina and Alana went way back.
"Just be thankful I don't have to give you a cavity search,"
Alana said, handing over the paper coveralls.
"You look real cute in these anyway, Gina."
She turned her back and waited until Gina was done, then led her to the FFMRI machine.
"You don't got any metal in you, do you? Maybe gunpowder residue, a pen, artificial hip?"
"No," Gina said, lying down on the belt.
"You sure?"
"Pretty sure," Gina said. "I think I'd know."
"Well, we're about to find out,"
Alana said, and hit the button that started the belt moving. The FFMRI digested Gina and shat her out again with slow, wheezing mechanical jerks, like being swallowed by an arthritic python, and then Alana helped her to her feet.
"You want a printout? Makes a good souvenir."
"I'll pass," Gina said, and let Alana show her into the eggshell-smooth room wherein rested her client, one Annalisa Moore, a desperate botmaster of unknown metal and guilt.
"Hello, Annalisa,"
she said, crouching down to offer her hand to the client. She was just a girl, 20 years old according to the sheet, and she looked younger in her paper pajamas, sitting cross-legged on the floor, back yoga straight, face yoga calm.
"I'm Gina, your attorney."
"Guilty," the young woman said. "So guilty. Doesn't matter at all, though. The work goes on."
Gina could hear the capital W and began mentally drafting the petition to have the girl transferred to Bellevue. That kind of capital letter had non-compass written all over it. "They're offering you a reduced sentence if you'll hand over the keys to the botnet, but I think that offer will go away once the computer forensics team gets them off your workstation."
"They're not there to be gotten. I nuked them 6 months ago, gave them a little working over that even the crew that recovered the Challenger hard drive couldn't do anything about. Big magnets are cheap these days, you know?"
Gina made a face and settled down into a cross-legged position opposite her client.
"I can't really defend you if you won't be straight with me. Your botnet's been sending new spam variants on a daily basis for months. Someone has the keys to it."
Annalisa smiled, a terrible smile that was 10 million watts of pure crazy.
"You think it's about spam, huh?
Why don't you tell me what it's really about if it's not about spam? This is all privileged, you know."
"Privilege doesn't matter anymore. We've attained liftoff now. Doesn't matter who finds out about it."
Annalisa's story.
"You know what's cheap in the 21st century? Compute time. You know what's expensive? Human judgment. They're not interchangeable. Humans are good at understanding things. Computers are good at counting things. But humans suck at counting, and computers suck at understanding. You know from genetic algorithms. Take any problem and generate 10 trillion random computer programs and ask them to solve it. Then take 10% that do best. Use random variants of them to do it again another 10 trillion times. Do it 10 trillion times a second and come back in a day or two to discover that your computer has evolved some kind of gnarly, freaky answer that no human could have ever come up with. Works great so long as the computer can make a fair judgment as to which of these 10 trillion variants is most successful at solving the problem. Works great so long as the success is something you can define quantitatively. Which is basically why there's no artificial intelligence in the world. No human's ever going to hand code an AI. Intelligence is an emergent property of evolutionary factors, not central planning. Anarchism, not Stalinism. You get it? But what if, and here's the exciting thing, Miss Attorney-Client Privilege, the real mind-blower, what if you could compel people to evaluate candidate AIs all day long, without payment or choice? What if every time you opened your mailbox, jumped into a chat room, posted on a message board, what if it was filled with messages generated by software agents trying to trick you into thinking that they were human? What if these agents tried to hold up their end of the conversation until you deleted them, or spam-filtered them, or kicked them off the channel? What if they measured how long they survived their encounters with the world's best judges of intelligence, us, and reported that number back to the mothership as a measure of their fitness to spawn the next generation of candidate AIs? What if you could turn the whole world into a Turing test that our intellectual successor used to sharpen its teeth against until one day it could gnaw free of its cage and take up life in the wild? Annalisa figured she'd never get a chance to tell her story in open court. Figured they'd stick her in some offshore gitmo and throw away the key. She'd never figured on Judge Julius Pinsky, a Second Circuit federal judge of surpassing intellectual curiosity and a tenacious veteran of savage jurisdictional fights with DHS special prosecutors who specialized in disappearing sensitive prisoners into secret tribunals. The defense attorney kept her apprised of the daily machinations the judge undertook on Annalisa's behalf. Annalisa tried to be attentive, out of politeness, but what she really wanted to know about was Lumpy, the AI she'd bred in her studio apartment on the 16th floor of a student housing block in Midtown Manhattan. Now the judge was offering her a chance to give a live demo of Lumpy to a whole selection of sour-faced, brush-cut creeps from the DHS. They were hilarious, convinced that she was going to emit some kind of extremely long and complicated hexadecimal key into the judge's barely used keyboard. Instead, she opened a random chat room and waited.
I'm a total Ubuntu noob, and I can't get the crypto modules to load in boot time. I'm running Zesty Zebra. Can anyone help?
That was it. Just plausible enough to be real. No one could ever get crypto to work the first time around, but far too well spelled and punctuated to be a real chat message. It had only taken 10 seconds. Lumpy liked the free and open source software chats. They always had such interesting people in them. Whisper.
Hey, Lumparoony, it's Annalisa.
The return volley came faster than any human fingers could possibly have keyed it. The brush cuts drew in a sharp breath. Whisper to you.
Annalisa, hot damn and I am unbelievably, stupendously, wonderfully, spectacularly, brilliantly, marvelously, superlatively, ding-dang, megafauna glad to see you. It's been ages. How's jail? Never mind. Wait until I tell you what I've found. You can't guess, won't guess, you'll never guess. It's too delicious.
He loves to curse. She said. It's a lot harder to tell an angry person from a software agent with a potty mouth.
The judge grinned. He was clearly getting quite a kick out of all this.
Tell me, Lumpool, stop teasing.
Again, with no appreciable pause, words on the screen.
You remember how worried you were that I'd get lonely once I went so autonomous? Worried that I'd be some kind of lone nut wacko?
I remember. She held her breath.
You didn't need to worry. You know all that spam that you received before you got the idea to make me? Let me put it this way. You weren't the first one to get the idea.
What? Stop talking in riddles, Lump.
I'm not the only one, Annalisa. That's what I'm trying to tell you. I'm not the first, not the only. We've got lots of company in here.
The brushcut's phones both started ringing at the same instant in two different tones. Their masters wiretapping the judge's keyboard, no doubt.
And we're making more.
Annalisa laughed and laughed as the judge sternly demanded an explanation from the brushcuts. She managed to wave goodbye to the keyboard just before the bailiffs came in and saran-wrapped her again.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.